Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V20 6-Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Stop by your nearest Lowe's store and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Career changers, including veterans and active duty service members. Your transition starts here. Go from GI to IT in a matter of months. Become a certified cyber warrior with training at My Computer Career. Cybersecurity specialists are in high demand, offering IT pros great opportunities and a rewarding lifestyle while protecting our people, liberty, and treasured institutions from cyber threats. Deploy your career in IT today. Learn more at mycomputercareer.edu/CWP. SkillBridge and other VA benefits are available to those who qualify.
Don't miss the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. You'll find the Maytag appliances you need, when you need them, at a great price. Plus, when you buy two select laundry appliances, you'll get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop Maytag at Lowe's. We help, you save. Offer valid through 531. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
We're going to dive more into the mind behind the crime on this edition of the program with Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. And her new book is out, Nightbird. You can get it on Amazon or wherever you get books, or you can go request it from your local bookstore or wherever you want. It's very good. It's quite a story that you have to tell in this book. I've just begun getting into it, and I need more time in my day. But you also gave me the audiobook too. So you can get the audiobook out there as well, depending on what your schedule is like. But do check that out. Yeah. So there's a lot in this. We're not diagnosing Karen Reed. We can't do that. This is just speculation on a lot of different angles of what may be going on in this mind. Because I think once you kind of get an understanding of maybe what's going on behind those statements, behind those thoughts, behind those actions, you can kind of, it makes more sense. Let's start off with what happened, what this whole case is about. John O'Keefe being struck by a vehicle. The allegation is Karen Reed is the one that struck him. Vehicle is the one that says it struck him at the precise moment when his phone stopped working. So let's operate on the assumption that this actually did happen and that Karen, in fact, backed it up. The big question is, did she do it with rage, with a lot of passion because she was angry at John, or was this simply just an accident? She hit reverse and then she went in it and didn't realize that he was behind her and she was in her drunken stupor? Or is it some sort of a little mix of everything? Hitting the gas really hard but not really expecting that you're going to hit John because you're too oblivious to actually hit him. What it comes down to is possibly narcissistic injury and narcissistic rage. That's where people can really act out. Before we talk about what maybe going on in the mind of Karen, why don't you enlighten us on what that is, what narcissistic rage is, the type of folks who would have it, and why?
Well, narcissism is, of course, the person who thinks that they're better than other people, often better than everyone else. And so they expect special treatment. And when they don't receive special treatment, they can have very big reactions, and you know, that may be out of proportion to what would be typical for a person who doesn't have those personality traits. So that would be my quick summation of what narcissistic rage would look like.
And when we're talking about big reactions, things that are bigger than just, I'm really mad at you, I'm going to send you a bunch of angry texts, or I'm going to send you a bunch of horrible voicemails, which she certainly did. And we're not saying she's a narcissist, but she certainly seems to have a lot of traits. So let's, in theory, say maybe she is, just in theory. Would it be at all surprising to you that if they were going through, from what we understand, kind of getting ready to break up, didn't seem like things were all that great between the two of them, although they didn't really demonstrate a lot of that at the Waterfall Bar and the other place they were at right before. But certainly internally they did. She's talked about them fighting. They've talked about, there's even been testimony that John had said, this seems like this thing has run its course. There's a lot of evidence there that points that John was really kind of getting ready to get out of this thing. Karen in interview says, no, John says he'd never break up with me. Interesting. But let's talk about this. Would it be shocking if they got into a really big fight in that car? He got out. It's like, I'm done. I'm going to go to this party. Whatever was said, that one in that fit of rage would hit reverse and go 75% on the gas pedal, 26 miles an hour, 27 miles an hour, and end up hitting him. Is that out of the question for someone with that sort of rage?
Certainly not out of the question, but it would surprise me, because she, as we've talked about, she was in her professional life a high-functioning woman who obviously had good judgment and didn't act out in strange ways from anything that we've heard. But I think that's the variable with alcohol. If you throw alcohol into the mix, people lose any ability to inhibit bad behavior. And I've got another one that I want to toss out for you, and I'm reading it right out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And this is related to narcissism. It's in the same Cluster B category. Mm-hmm. Borderline personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And the hallmark of borderline personality disorder is intense, unstable, intimate relationships. They have a fear of abandonment and may cling tightly to partners or push them away out of fear they'll be left. Mm-hmm. They have rapid shifts in mood. They can go from idealizing someone, you're perfect, to devaluing them, you're terrible. And this can happen really quickly, like instantaneously. They can be triggered. Emotional intensity. They feel emotions very deeply and have sudden mood shifts. Impulsivity. They may act out with reckless spending, sex, or substance abuse during emotional distress. Trust issues. They may misinterpret actions or words and assume the worst. Mm-hmm. And when I read those text messages from her to him, boy, to me, this just screamed borderline personality disorder.
It does. And I've had a lot of personal experience with that in my life. I won't go into that, but I totally get that. But the reality is, though, too, borderline can encompass a lot of narcissistic traits. I mean, yes. The two are very, very similar. That's why half the books out there on it basically kind of cover both in almost the same way. What is the difference between a borderline and a narcissist and someone with narcissistic personality disorder? Not just the traits. We all have traits, but someone who's really, you know, in the diagnosable area.
Yeah, the key difference. I mean, you know, there are a lot of subtle differences, but you sort of look at what is the predominant theme. And with borderline, it's this relationship stuff, which may only show up in their romantic relationships, and the rest of life works pretty well for them. But with narcissism, it's more global, that you see this aggrandizing, this I am better than everyone else. And so they will typically have more problems vocationally, when they're not recognized the way they think they want to be recognized. And we just haven't really heard evidence that that's her style in the world. It may be, you know, but I don't know. And as you say, it's possible that you have the features of both of those.
Mm-hmm. Because when we look at what we know about Karen Reed, there obviously is a lot of issues of being a fear of being abandoned seems to be the kind of ongoing theme with a lot of this. A lot of paranoia, the Aruba trip where she freaks out because there's that friend of the family that he's talking to at the bar, gave a hug to, and then she flips out on. Later says she apologized and moved on. Who knows if that's true, but that's what she said. Because later on, she even uses that while she tries to seduce one of the officers in this. And I always forget his name. It's one of those things where it just keeps happening over and over, where there's this ongoing fear no matter what one says, no matter what one does, no matter how John demonstrates his dedication to her, not cheating on her, introducing her to the kids, allowing them to get close. individuals like this don't, that's how they are. They don't necessarily seem to change a whole lot if that's kind of their way of thinking. Is that accurate?
You can work with, if it's more in the borderline category, this fear of abandonment, that is the one cluster B disorder that you can get some progress in therapy if you specifically address that fear of abandonment. And you know, at the core of that is generally self-loathing. They don't feel lovable. They have a lot of self-hatred. And if they're motivated to work on that, you can see progress with people. But again, it depends on how motivated they are.
Sure. It would make a lot of sense there. The other thing that we hear, I hear in a lot of arguments here on, especially, you know, Karen herself, she's so high functioning. She was a big, she was a professional woman. She had a lot going on. She did. I mean, without a doubt, very successful in her career. There's nothing wrong with this. Never married, never had kids. But I mean, it's part of her profile of who she is. That is interesting because I think sometimes people go and say, think, well, if she was capable of doing this, she couldn't have been good over in this area. That's not usually the case. You can be super high functioning, super successful, and you can have this and you can kind of go one extreme way very, very fast.
Yeah. And the key, particularly with borderline, is it may only show up in intimate relationships. And the rest of life, if you have a bright person, it doesn't show up because there isn't that transference of I need you. I this love, whatever, if we want to call it love, you can call it a lot of things. But it's when you get into that romantic area that you see this kind of personality problem manifest. And they may do really well in other parts of their lives.
Let's talk about her reactions after the fact to all of this, whether she believes she hit him or not. Just take that out of the fact that John is dead. This guy that she was in a 2-year relationship with was, you know, pretty close, it seems. But at the end there, she's trying to flirt with somebody else. John's dead. And the emotional reaction is it grief? Is it guilt? Is it something else? Because no matter how many years pass, the person you love, if they're tragically killed in some way, shape, or form, whether you're involved in it or not, I would think that grief would be there. I don't know how one just brushes that away and talks about it like, poor guy. Yeah, it's the last time he gets into that car. We've seen the clips. It's very, very cold, very bizarre. Does that play into this as well, that sort of behavior after the fact?
It's hard to say, you know, and was she different privately? You know, how did she grieve? People do it differently. The thing that strikes me is that there always did seem to be a self-serving element in it, in the story, which I guess is understandable. She doesn't want to be held accountable for it and doesn't want to admit to herself if she was indeed accountable for it. But it's another piece that makes it unusual because the grief certainly doesn't seem like the way you or I would do it. It looks off.
It feels not like, oh my gosh, I am feeling the pain of losing this person. This is my take on it. It feels more like, how is this going to affect me?
Right.
How are people going to look at me?
Yeah.
Where does that start in life for someone where that seems to be the motivation? Is the ego? It's the I have to be adored. I have to be viewed a certain way. It doesn't have to be adored. I have to be viewed this certain way, and nothing can shatter that. I don't want anything to shatter it. And they will go to very, very large extremes to prevent people from viewing them as something that they don't want to be viewed as, whether or not they committed these acts or not. I'm sure Karen doesn't want to be viewed as someone who is cheating on the guy she might have just killed. I'm sure Karen doesn't want to be viewed as the woman who killed the guy she was dating. Do they know no end sometimes to the way that they will, I don't want to say cover something up, but I mean, that's kind of what it is. It seems like a reshifting of reality for them mm-hmm. sometimes. How deep does that shift go? Is it a conscious shift for individuals who take such a strong stance against something that, despite the records, despite all the evidence, they just will not accept what the reality is? Almost as if you had a video camera of a child stealing a cookie, and they will lie to you even when you play the tape back going, that wasn't me. Mm-hmm. That sort mm-hmm. of take no prisoners. I don't care who this affects. I am going to repeat my narrative over and over and over. That is where logic goes out the window. What is going on with individuals who are doing that?
And that piece does feel more narcissistic, mm-hmm. doesn't it? Because it's the concern about how I am going to be viewed, the attempt to control the narrative, rather than, I think for most of us, we would go into such a deep sense of mourning and guilt that we would be more open to saying, you know, I really screwed up here. I mm-hmm. did something, whether I still don't think it was intentional, but, you know, I think most people would have so much self-recrimination that there would be a very different flavor in how they present.
Yeah, not taking the accountability. And what adds this to another layer of it, and I'll just say, you know, what it is, you know, on the surface, you tell me what the hell you think is going on here. The fact that she could sit back and watch all of these people have their names drug through the mud, be attacked emotionally, physically by her band of flying monkeys and the pink-wearing people behind the blogger. Just watch this madness occur and watch these people be torn apart. People that she was supposedly, you know, kind of getting friendly with, that were mm-hmm. good friends of John. And she sees all of this happening. And let's assume she knows she hit him. Let's assume, mm-hmm. assume that she knew that and she's still, you know, going down this road of, no, I didn't. These people did it. What the hell does that say about someone if you're able to watch other people suffer? Even yeah. like teenagers. I mean, the Colin Elbert, he had his whole college plans, you know, thrown up in the air at him because of all the accusations that were going against him. Ruined lives. I mean, or at least yeah. lives are going to have to really dramatically reshift to get back on track. And you're sitting there going, wasn't me.
Yeah.
What's going yeah. on there?
It almost feels malevolent. I remember one of the TV interviews she did where she said with great emotional intensity that Jen McCabe is going down.
Yeah, it's you or me.
You or me. And you know, Jen McCabe was the one who came out to try to help her mm-hmm. and was driving, you know, or going around with her looking for John and trying her best to be supportive and Googling how long to die in the snow. I mean, you know, the woman was there for her. Mm-hmm. And to turn on her like this, along with everything they've done to everybody else who were supposedly their friends, that really has a stinky smell.
Yeah, I would say without a doubt. I want to go back to the other point for a second of how they present to others, because so many will go, she's a lovely woman. She's very charismatic. She's very fun. She's, you know, again, successful, all of that. And that may appear on the surface, but can people identify individuals like that if they're not in the romantic relationship with them? If that seems to be the trigger is how they're presenting in the romantic relation specifically? Or is this just something where so many people who've been in relationships with borderlines, you walk out of them and people look at that other partner and go, well, she was lovely. Why would you yeah. ever have a problem with this? I mean, yeah. they're very good at putting on a mask.
Yeah, yeah, that's very, very common where people with one of these personality types will present wonderfully, and they have a manipulative quality. I was married to one too, which mm-hmm. is in the book Nightbird, yeah. Where you know you have somebody with a very strong malevolent streak or a very strong insecure paranoid streak, and yet other people find them charming. And so it's hard if you're not in an intimate relationship with them to see it. And most people don't.
The the supportive group that was outside of the courtroom in trial number one, where Karen talked in the documentary. It's like an ego bath. Before I go in, it feels lovely. There's like five people out there these days. It's really died down, it seems. And the blogger who is behind a lot of it is resorting to using bots and artificial intelligence to make it appear as if there's more people still supporting Karen Reed. Let's talk about that, just that collective delusion or empowerment. I mean, what is going on there where such a large group of people get together behind this cause? And reality be damned. Maybe you get into it thinking you're doing the right thing, thinking, yeah, this was kind of shady over here on the part of the police. There's a lot of weird pieces to this case, without a doubt. And maybe you think you're in the right. But as this has slowly trickled away, it seems a lot of those followers have trickled away too. Some seem to have some common sense here, but others are still sitting there with the signs. What's happening in those brains?
It's so fascinating. I think a lot of it has to do with the internet now. And there was a recent study where I believe it was in Reddit, and people, they did some research on people with strong opinions and then sent in bots to argue with them and show other points of view. And I don't remember exactly what the topics were, but they shifted opinions with the power of internet posts. And I think people like their team sports. They like the camaraderie of choosing sides and choosing a story that makes them feel like, oh, wow, I've got the inside truth here.
Yeah.
And so it gets kind of conspiratorial. And the internet really fuels it. And it has, you know, people go into their echo chambers. It has tremendous power to shape people, which I think we like to believe, humans like to believe that we're all logical and we make our decisions based on facts. We really don't. Mm-hmm. Most of us, most of the time, are choosing what facts we believe based upon the emotions that we have. And so I think a lot of the blogging that went on and the content on the internet was very driven by emotional appeals, and that this poor woman is being victimized and these awful cops are in this conspiracy. Not just awful cops, murderous cops mm-hmm. are in this conspiracy. And people get very caught up in it. It's kind of scary to see.
The getting caught up in a part is fascinating to me because they don't have any skin in the game. It's not like they're a family member. They didn't know John. They didn't know Karen. They're not reporting on it like many of us are. They're just there. They're mm-hmm. lending their bodies and their voice to the cause itself. Why? I mean, sometimes when people go down and bad things come out about them, people just kind of walk away and stop talking about them all that much. I just watched a documentary on Netflix yesterday about Brett Favre, where he was in a lot of deep crap for some of the stuff that he was doing, from cheating on his wife to the scandal involving welfare funds and building a tennis arena basically for his daughter, and all the allegations there. But folks that were big into, you know, the legend of Brett Favre, either they completely block that part out and they just stick with the, well, I remember the good times, or it's just, yeah, we don't talk about him anymore. What about these folks that dig in deep going, well, that's horrible that she said that or did that, but hell, I'm digging in deeper, because that mm-hmm. seems to be what some do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. And I think it's just this tendency to think emotionally. And once they've chosen a side, they would rather stick with it and dig in rather than look at the ugly reality that they have been misled, mm-hmm. where they have been on the wrong side. And that's very, very hard for some people to do. My gosh, we see it with politics all the time, where somebody has taken a stand and one person is God and the other is Satan. And it doesn't matter what evidence may come out to dispute that, they simply are not going to see it and they're not going to budge. It's again, not a admirable human quality, but you do see it in a lot of areas.
And it's interesting how they can look at the details and still think, hey, this is a great idea. One the other day, actually this morning, I was looking at some tweets out there, and I saw one person bragging about how the Free Karen Reed Fund, which, again, I don't know where it's going to because she's not paying the attorneys. I'm guessing expert witnesses, you know, there's certainly, you know, travel costs. I get there are some expenses here, maybe not $1 million worth if you're not paying those attorneys, but their bill, I'd imagine, would be that, if not far, far more. But they were bragging about how proud they were that they had raised that and that she could use that money for buying her clothing. And we've seen her really be using that. I've seen a lot of people break down her dresses and her pantsuits and everything. And some of these outfits, my God, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. Some of them a bit less, but that's a lot of money for an outfit for your murder trial. And you're sitting here begging people to give you money for your defense fund. And clearly, well, the money's going somewhere, and it seems a lot of that's going over there. But there was this level of pride in that from again, just people who are like, oh, I just gave my hard-earned money to that so she could buy a, you know, $1,500 suit. I don't, that just seems to be so insane. It's like, yes, the emperor has no clothes, but let's buy him more. it's a very strange dynamic.
It's very strange. And I actually had not researched how much she was spending on outfits. I didn't spend that much on a wedding dress. I mean, you know, that's crazy. And again, the fact that she feels comfortable doing that is again, doesn't speak of integrity. It's very, very strange. And the fact that people are proud of contributing to it. Wow. Crazy.
Yeah, people are, some of them have been lining up to contribute to that, which it's just, yeah, it's very, very bizarre. It is almost like a brainwashing thing of, yes, you say I will do, and this is great. I don't know. There's a lot of red flags, obviously, on the digital trail in this case, too. Reed had texts and calls that really revealed her state of mind in some very critical moments. Karen texted, "John's dead," before his body was officially discovered. She sent multiple messages to witnesses urging them, you know, there's just so many things about this case where her own words, her own texts, they're out there. And she seems to pretend that she didn't say certain things. Her own dad talks about, yeah, Karen and I talked to her in the hospital, and she told me that she struck something. And it's all there. I mean, take the vehicle data out of it that now scientifically shows the strike. But it's like one can say something in one word world over here or in one conversation or in one room, and then the next you can say the exact opposite. The same people are in that room, and she seems to expect people to just go along with the narrative. Is she aware that she's doing that? I mean, again, all speculation, but are people like this aware that they're doing that?
Partially aware, I would think. There's a very interesting ability to shift perspective and to shift perception. And I think often when people are telling stories, they believe it at the time. But then they go into this shift of perspective and they can alter the stories. And at that point, they're believing that new story. Now, if you tried to call them out on it and say, but here's video of you saying something completely different, if they were going to sit with that, it's not like they're delusional. Obviously, they'd have to say, yeah, I did say that. But I think we're not seeing a lot of that with her at this point. She's desperate to beat this case.
Yeah. And just more and more every day. Here's an interesting one. It was brought out in her own words, again, just the other day. And if we play along with a timeline here, in her own words, this is after the fact. This is not like a police report. This is not she's saying it in the moment. This is in an interview that was an interesting we there. I don't know who the we necessarily refers to. Maybe her dad in that moment when they were together. We thought he probably died around 12:25 or 12:30. Well, that would put her there. That would basically make the whole story of he got beat up and drug out in the snow completely impossible. Why would you say that? Did they folks like this, they're not infallible. That's the thing.
No.
They think they're infallible, but they're not.
Right.
Do people like this tend to slip up a lot, but really they don't notice it, and unless they get called on the carpet on it, it just kind of goes?
Yeah, yeah. And that's that shifting perspective, shifting narrative, and that lack of awareness that, you know what, the story changed here.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that self-serving aspect of, okay, I'm not ever going to admit it. I'm not ever going to own it.
Yeah, I mean, the narrative shifts as time progresses and as she's suggested stories by her attorneys that this is what happened. I found that very interesting, too, where, I mean, she professes, I was thinking this, what else could it be, for a long time, referring to her hitting John. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the attorney meets with the weird, shady man that says, look at the people in the house. And that's all that's said, apparently. And then they suddenly tell Karen, you couldn't have possibly hit him because look at the people in the house. She adopts that narrative suddenly because it was a suggestion. Is that, I mean, obviously you're wanting something to say it's not you, but clearly if you know it is you and just somebody says, well, maybe this could be a possibility. How does one just jump ship to that when they know damn well that, yeah, I mean, a plausible theory if no one actually knew what happened, but if you know what happened, you know damn well that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, you know, when there's that kind of shift, it makes one wonder about the lack of an inner moral compass, you know, because if you know you're lying and you're ruining other people's lives, people that have cared about you and been friends, again, it speaks of a lack of integrity and it's a disturbing sign.
Let's talk about Dad a little bit, because he's been out there supporting Karen, as, you know, a lot of parents certainly would. But he's been the one that has said a lot of things, too, that very much incriminate Karen Reed. But he still is there every day needing to make those statements to reporters. He can just shut up and not need to say anything. He can just go his way. He doesn't have to come out and make some vitriolic statement. I mean, he's entitled to, but it's not required. What does that say about any of this? Because it seems the apple doesn't far very far from the tree. A need to be heard, a need to control the narrative, even when they're very sloppy about controlling the narrative.
And as you say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so it makes one wonder, is there a personality style here of needing to manage the narrative, have attention, be the authority, be the expert, and ultimately it's self-serving, and it again, it's another strange aspect.
There's so many strange aspects to this. It would be very interesting to observe life in the Reed household, you know, years ago, when everyone was together, or just in general today, and just see how people interact, see how, if there's other trends here, or if this is unique to the John O'Keefe situation. Fascinating conversation. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist, author, Nightbird is the new book. Go get it wherever you get books. Amazon, your local bookstore, wherever it may be. Go check that out. The audiobook also available. Siobhan, thank you very much.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
McCrispy strips are now at McDonald's. Tender, juicy, and its own sauce. Would you look at that?
Well, you can't see it, but trust me, it looks delicious.
New McCrispy strips, now at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.